Welcome back. You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show. We're about to have a conversation with Dr. Jessica Schiller. She's an assistant professor of education at the Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development at Towson University, where she focuses on urban education. Been a guest on the show before talking about educational issues. She was named Emerging Educational Leader by the Phi Delta Kappa magazine and was with us today to talk about her new book, a really new book, The New Reality of Suburban Schools, how suburban schools are struggling with low-income students and students of color in their schools. And Jessica, welcome. Good to have you with us here back on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, one just by yourself, which is good.
Exciting.
So let's talk about this. You're a professor of urban education, but you're writing about suburban education.
Right.
So talk about what the process of what led you to start investigating suburban schools.
That's a great question. You're right. Most of my career has been in urban education and still remains there in many regards. But one thing that I've been thinking about more and more is the urban-suburban binary and how it is it's a fallacy, really. Mm-hmm. That we have for a long time and still today to some degree have we think about urban and suburban as opposites. Suburban being white and relatively affluent, urban being largely poor, people of color. And that's just not the truth anymore. I write in the book about an experience I had about 10 years ago. My sister, who's a lot younger than me, graduated from the same high school I did. When I attended, the school in suburban New Jersey was largely white. And by the time she graduated, it was largely people of color. And I was really surprised by this myself. And that led me to start poking around some of the demographic data and to see, you know, what's going on in the suburbs. And lo and behold, they've changed dramatically in the last 15
throughout
years.
Throughout the country.
Throughout the
schools
country.
You picked, they're everywhere.
Absolutely. These are just, you know, examples of something you see everywhere. And so we really can't. In many ways, suburban schools are urban in that regard.
So that this is interesting because it's the same thing here in the Baltimore region as it is everywhere else. And thinking about your book, I actually had a long talk with my daughter, my youngest daughter, who is actually just a freshman now in college. And she went to one of those schools in Marietta, Georgia, Marietta High School, which was a suburban school that was – I think she is the way she described it was, and I was I spent a lot of time with her there. 85% African American or Mexican American, and maybe 15% white, maybe less. So, and she had an incredible experience there. But this kind of change is happening everywhere. So what's been the? Let's talk about some of the schools that you picked,
right?
And what they're saying to you about this, it's like Landfield Middle.
So Landfield Middle is a school like the one you just described. It's not right. far from a city line. It's demographically largely kids of color. It was once very white, and also has a huge immigrant population, South Asian, Southeast Asian in particular, and lots of kids with Middle Eastern origins, and even Central and South American students, and so the demographics for the kids, the encounters kids have on a daily basis at that school are incredibly different than they would have been for kids of my generation or your generation growing up in that same place. And the movement of people over the city line has been something that's happening all over, like you said. The suburbs have sort of so-called opened up at a certain point where, you know, post-civil rights era, people started moving to the suburbs for the same reason that white folks started moving to the suburbs originally, to seek better opportunity, bigger houses, closer to employment and things like that. And then the problems sort of ensue from there that people of color, when they move to the suburbs, end up in certain communities rather than
So, but what was it about? So, let's talk about the transition that some of these schools have taken. Whether we're talking about the schools in Barrow County or the Goodwin Middle School. I mean, so what? Talk about the transition in those communities. I mean, you talk a lot about the history of the segregation of the suburbs, as laying out your kind of argument here around the GI Bill of Rights, the GI Bill, and the flight to the suburbs and this being built, and how that kind of and how that interaction between that history and the reality of today is, how they intersect.
Right. So the so just going back to the GI Bill for a second, you know, a lot of people don't realize that the GI Bill really benefited white folks,
right,
only. And it was sort of by design. So so the growth of the suburbs became, you know, a growth of white communities throughout the country. Now, that changed in the 80s. Pretty much when, as I said, you know, after the civil rights movement sort of ends, African-American folks in particular start moving into the suburbs in the, you know, kind of late 70s and early 80s in seek of better opportunity because in search of better opportunity in the cities. There's just such massive divestment happening at that same time that middle class African-American families decide, you know, we need schools for our kids. We need, you know, we want better homes. We're gonna move to suburbs just like white Americans did. And as our immigrant population increased after the 60s and broadened to reach all kinds of places all over the world, those folks also, many still come to cities. You know, New York, Chicago, L.A. Full of immigrants. I'm not trying to say that they're all coming to the suburbs, but many of them do come actually stepping over the city completely and going directly to the suburb because they think it's safer and that they'll have access to better opportunity. In the same way, the suburb has always sort of symbolized better opportunity in the American psyche. And so, you know, people of color are no different than whites in trying to seek that out. And so that demographic change happened. But as it was happening, white folks saw that and started moving away from the communities that people of color were moving into or congregated in their own spaces. So that what we have now in the suburbs is still segregation in the same way that we had, you know, kind of that urban-suburban boundary that separated the two. Now in the suburbs, there are largely white suburbs separated by suburbs that are largely populated by people of color.
And it's also this ex-urban world that's been grown, exactly, which is where white folks have fled to. There's not much more room to flee, I think. But what happens inside the schools? What's the dynamic that changes once the population changes and becomes people of color? And you still have a mostly, as you describe, most of the teachers, the academic body of faculty, are white and have stayed in that school even though it transitioned, right?
Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately, not a lot changes. And that's part of the problem that I found in doing the research for the book was that because the faculties of schools, and that's true everywhere, right, is mostly white. Over 85% of public school teachers are white in this country.
That's a shocking number.
It is a shocking number.
I mean, I'm reading what you wrote, but I was not. I mean, I living here in Baltimore. Even looking at the surrounding county schools, that's not the case. And you know, it's a much more racially mixed faculty in most schools. And so that was really kind of a shocking piece of information. Why is that? What does that say?
That's always been the case for many, many, many years. When we had segregated schools, we had black teachers and we had white teachers. And when we integrated schools, a lot of those black teachers lost their jobs because white communities didn't want black teachers teaching their kids. And also post-civil rights, a lot of black folks sought a better opportunity in other careers and other fields. And we struggle to recruit and retain teachers of color everywhere. The other piece of the white teacher phenomenon, though, I think is about trying to train young people. And the way we think of schools is socializing young people into what America is all about. And I think symbolically having, you know, a white, particularly a female, up in the front of the room is the way we think of best socializing young folks into what it is to be American. And so in colleges of education like the one I work in, you know, we have largely white students. And the problem with that is that they've grown up in white communities. They don't have any experience, very little experience interacting with people of color. Many of them are middle class and affluent. They don't have any experience interacting with poor kids. And so they go to colleges of education. They learn how to teach. They learn how to write great lesson plans and do all that kind of stuff. And because they have no experience, though, socially with diverse groups, they really don't know how to reach the kids that they're teaching. So in these suburban schools, they're really confused by what to do.
So, talk a bit about some examples. I mean, in the schools you visited, I mean, and whether you know the Landfield or Goodwin, the places in Barrow County, describe the community that you saw, and what kind of jumped out at that moment. I mean, I know you expect us to see some things because you're a scholar and you've studied these things, but there must have been some things that really describe the things that kind of hit you.
Absolutely. I was surprised, frankly, by the level of diversity in all the schools. Going into those communities, I was surprised by the kind of economic depression that you saw. These are suburban communities, and yes, they're working class communities to a large degree.
Yeah, right.
I actually didn't expect to see as much kind of economic depression as I saw. Single family homes occupied by lots and lots of people turned into rentals with multiple families living in them. Kinds of things that you might expect to see in poor city neighborhoods, right? Check cashing places, liquor stores, throughout the community, and because there are suburbs, there's not a lot of walking spaces, and so you don't, you know, see a lot of people out on the street.
Right.
Yet these are largely communities, actually a lot of families that don't have access to transportation themselves, and so you wonder how people are getting around and what they're doing. In the schools themselves, like Landfield and Goodwin in particular, these are middle schools with, you know, 6th through 8th grades. They're average schools in terms of the population. They have, you know, about 500 or 600 kids in them. They're organized in very traditional ways. In very conventional ways, you know, everyone takes math, science, English, and all that. What I was surprised by mostly, I guess, was that the school looked very much like the junior high that I went to in the 1980s. That the way it was, the schedule that the kids had every day
hadn't changed.
The lockers, the lunchroom, what kids were talking about and doing after school, and you know what they were doing in gym class. All that was entirely the same as it had been when I had gone to school. And for me, that's probably the most surprising thing.
Now, one of the things that it's curious here, and I was thinking about this is in the book, is that you theoretically think that people who are trained as teachers would be able to be effective teachers to any student. So talk about what the missing element is here.
There are a couple missing elements. One is that the preparation of teachers does not really include cultural competence. We don't do a good job of not just teaching new teachers about diversity, because that we do that, but we don't teach teachers how to learn about new cultures and new people that they haven't encountered before, and we don't teach them how to create relationships with them. So teachers come into the schools and they don't really know how to talk to parents, of the kids. They don't know how to set up a relationship with them or have a conference with them that's productive. They make all kinds of assumptions about kids' lives outside of school or what they value, what they don't, what their histories are. And we don't really take the time to teach them, you know, what the value is of gathering information about kids' lives outside of school and using it in school. So I think that's one area where they're not really prepared, because we do at colleges of education like the one I work at, I think we do a really good job of focusing on curriculum and assessment and things like that, but we don't really focus on how to connect.
Mm-hmm. So how do you teach that?
Well, it's something that I'm thinking about all the time. In fact, I have a...
Because in the back, I mean, you end up your book with a lot of recommendations about where you think you might go. So, I mean, how do you teach that?
Yeah, I think you can't teach it out of a book. You can't learn it in a classroom. You have to get people out into communities to learn from the people themselves. So we need many more courses that are practical, that have students out there working in community-based organizations or in churches or mosques or... interacting in nonprofits with community folks and in schools too, but there are lots of spaces where people go where you can learn about who they are, and just in the way that we have students do their internships and they student teach in classrooms, there's no reason why we can't have them out working in a community-based organization doing some kind of practical work while at the same time learning about the people who work there and attend those spaces.
So in your interactions with teachers in some of the schools, I mean, what was their – describe a little bit about their interactions with them when you went to visit schools, especially the teachers.
So the teachers were really defensive.
Right.
For the most part.
You weren't shocked by that when you hit the door.
I wasn't shocked by that. Right. No, but – but my job then was to try and earn their trust, because I had to, you know, I was hanging out in their schools and their classrooms, but they were very suspicious. And in part, that's because of the kind of overall environment that teachers exist in, right? They're constantly evaluated. Their test scores matter,
right.
And they're suspicious, I think, of all kinds of visitors, but they're also not very used to visitors that are just doing research and trying to find out what's going on in the schools. And because they're not used to it, they're suspicious of that as well, and what the data is going to be used for and how it's going to be, who's it going to be shared with and all that kind of stuff. So I really made a lot of effort to make sure that the data was shared back with the schools themselves, with the teachers and the administrators, so they knew what was going on. I offered to do workshops or any kind of follow up they wanted to help them with any of the problems that we saw, and but the teachers themselves, you know, they did a lot of explaining away a lot of the times of what was going on in their classrooms.
Take some of those conversations you had that you talk about, and kind of just describe one or two for our listeners.
Sure,
just to give a real essence of what that was like.
Sure. So like at Goodwin Middle, I spent a lot of time in an English classroom with a young woman who was a relatively new teacher, I think in her second or third year of teaching. And she, you know, she didn't know what to do with me. But she gave me a big notebook of all of her lesson plans for me to look through, which I did. But I was really much more interested in her interactions with the students, who she called on, how she talked to kids, what kinds of things she taught to them. And we would talk after class a little bit about her classroom. So, you know, I would ask her, you know, how she thought it went or what she was going to do next that next day. And without really responding to my question, she would day after day kind of explain, you know, why this child was a problem. And she wishes the administrators would just, you know, rearrange her classes, take certain kids out. It would be so much easier if she didn't have certain kids in her classroom, how she tried to reach out to their parents and they never really responded to her. And that's because they probably didn't value education.
Right.
That's, you know, that's one example. At Landfield, I had some teachers that were pretty negative, pretty harsh about their students. So in another English classroom there, I was in a class with a more veteran teacher. And in these schools, a veteran teacher is like a teacher who's taught, you know, maybe 7 or 8 years.
Right.
So because there's a lot of turnover.
Which is amazing because veteran teachers, you know, reading that stuff, calling those veteran teachers.
Right.
Veteran teachers growing up are like people who had been there 25, 30 years. In this, right.
I know. And, you know, and in these schools, it's hard to find those teachers. Right. They're there. They're there. But they, you know, it's hard to find them. Oh, but this teacher that
I'm
thinking of.
No,
it's okay. It's okay. This teacher in particular she was given all the English language learners in her classroom, and she had a really difficult time connecting to and relating to them. And their way, as I observed in the classroom, you know, their way of sort of getting over in the class, because they saw that she wasn't really that interested in him, was sort of to pretend that they didn't understand what she was talking about, when in fact, you know, they very much did. And I know that because I talked to them, and I know that, you know, they understood enough English to understand what was going on in that class. She would get very frustrated with them and in a way that you might expect to hear from Donald Trump or something. You know, why don't they just learn English? And, you know, their parents are here so that they can learn English, and they're slow to learn, and they also, you know, don't really care. I thought it was really interesting because the kids were just, you know, that was their way of trying to deal with the situation that was very alienating for them. But the teacher had no idea. Like, she never really sat down and talked to the kids enough to connect with them, tell them about her life. And
you think that would have happened had the students been white?
Well, I know it would have happened only in that she did have like this teacher in particular had good relationships with the white kids. She grew up in upstate New York, felt a lot of connection to the kind of working class white kids that were in her classroom that came from, you know, working class white community in that school. That was just she said, you know, this is very much like, you know, they're growing up very much how I grew up. And she had great relationships with those kids. They stayed after class. She took them to lunch. She would go to their games after school. And so she was involved in some kids' lives, but just not all the kids.
So, you know, when you going through this, and I actually was not shocked by a lot of stuff that you discovered. But before I go there, here's another question. Talk a bit about your interactions with the students. And in relationship to the conversations you have with the teachers for our listeners.
So the students, that was probably the most interesting, I mean, more fun part of the research for me. They were also, though, not used to talking to researchers.
Right.
And so they wanted to know, you know, what this was all about and why they were asked to talk to me. But I – because I did, you know, have formal focus groups with them, but I spent a lot of time just creating relationships with them informally in the classrooms and kind of in the cafeteria and after school and things like that. And they really welcomed the opportunity to talk about their lives and what was going on at the school. One time I was walking down the hallway at Landfield Middle, and there was a kid kind of sitting on the floor, you know, by himself during class. So because I was running late, actually, and I was about to go into a class, and he was sitting by himself. And he, you know, he said just like, you know, nobody wants to talk to me. I don't really, you know, I don't fit here at this school. And that was a really common experience that I had, you know, a common opinion that I had heard from students that that kid and I ended up talking for, you know, about half an hour during that morning that he was sitting there to find out what was going on with him. His parents had come here from Sri Lanka not that long ago, And he really didn't understand what was going on at the school. He didn't understand kind of how things worked, where he was, you know, what happened after sixth grade and seventh grade, and you know, what was the whole deal with middle school and high school. But he played a huge role in his family's life as a kind of a translator for them, and so was trying to navigate all these different worlds, but had no real connections with any adults at the school. And kids would say that, you know, kind of over and over again, but especially at Landfield, where they felt like very alienated. But the kids had lots of things to say about their own lives. They were really interesting and doing great things. And, you know, some were artists and musicians and played big roles in their churches and were planning quinceañeras and, you know, all kinds of exciting, cool things. But that the school, the adults at the school really had no idea about.
So I'm curious, you know, When you approached these schools and walked away, and we've talked before, so I know that you have this kind of ideas about where you would things have to change and how you would make them change. But what was altered for you because of your journey to these schools?
What was altered for me?
Yeah, in terms of your ideas about what has to be done. Did they
right,
you know what I'm saying?
Right. Yeah, I do know what you're saying.
Because,
yeah,
I mean, you've talked to me even on the show before about what we have to do to prepare the teachers.
Sure. Yeah. Well, I think that's, you know, that's still true. But given, you know, what's going on at the schools, there's so much more that needs to happen. So, I mean, one clear thing that has to happen is that they need some relief from the testing regimen that goes on at schools. Like, one thing that prevented interactions between teachers and students was the testing mandate, because there was so much testing, there was very little time for anything else, or the teachers felt like there was very little time for anything else. And so most of their time was spent prepping kids for tests. And their evaluations are tied to those test scores. There's a lot of risk for them. There's a lot involved in that. If there was a way to lift some of those mandates, and from the district on, you know, down to the state level, then there would be more room and more possibility in those classrooms. I mean, there's no doubt about it that you'd have to fill that time with something else. And I'm not saying that would automatically lead to, you know, great relationships between teachers and students, but that's one stumbling block. Another thing that needs to happen, I think, is for there to be real professional development for adults at school to really understand how to connect and build relationships with kids and families. And then the other thing is that we do have schools that are doing this very well. And in my own experience and research, actually, you know, ironically, they're in cities. City schools, you know, have
much maligned city schools.
Right. Much maligned city schools. Not all of them, but many of them have had a long track record and experience building relationships with communities of color and poor communities of color, because that's who they face. So a city like Baltimore has, you know, community school coordinators that are those liaisons between the communities and the schools, and they help do that in their school. They help teach the teachers how to do that. And the suburbs don't have – there is no such position that thinks about that kind of role and does that work. So I really think it would be interesting to pair up some of these struggling suburban schools with city schools across those boundaries so they can learn to see how to do those things.
What a frightening revolutionary idea, Jessica.
Crazy as it seems.
But no, and so if you want to hear a whole lot more about Dr. Jessica Schiller and her work, and she'll be on the show, you'll hear her again here in part of our panels. But I would encourage you to meet her and discuss the book at Towson University's Cook Library, February the 17th, next week. And the New Reality of Suburban Schools, she'll be there talking about her book. You can go to cooklibrary.towson.edu. We'll have the information on our What time is that? It doesn't
it's
say.
It's at 5 p.m.
5 p.m. Before showing you, this is a really, really interesting book. I think the kind of discussions we have to have, especially in where we live here in the urban suburban world of Baltimore metropolitan area, this book is particularly relevant for all we have to wrestle with. Dr. Jessica Schiller, again, Assistant Professor of Education in the Department of Instructional Leadership and Professional Development at Towson University. The book, The New Reality for Suburban Schools, How Suburban Schools Are Struggling with Low-Income Students and Students of Color in Their Schools. So meet her this February 17th, and all the information will be on our website at the Cook Library in Towson. Good to see you, Jessica. Thank you
so much, Mark.
We have to take a brief break. When we come back, it's a brand new episode of Soundbites. So stay with us. We'll look at why the United Nations is calling attention to the negative health impacts for a proposed incinerator in Baltimore's Curtis Bay neighborhood. And we'll learn what compelled a middle school teacher in Salisbury to demand better treatment for Purdue's chickens. Stay with us.